Excellent. All right. It's great to welcome me to Many Rivers Books and Tea.
Welcome.
I've been here almost all day. Welcome, Rob. Welcome, Stuart, who spends less time here. Stuart Goodnick is, of course, one of the founders of this institution and helps run it still, but more remotely than I. But nevertheless, importantly, in fact, he's the person who has been putting the talks that we record here at the store on the web, among other many, many duties. No, come on. After all the many years you've been doing it, just because you're a little behind now doesn't mean that anything's so terrible. So Stuart has been practicing Tai Yu meditation for, what would it be, over 30 years now. And I just passed 39 years myself, also one of the founders of the store here, along with our friend Jim over there. So, karma. What is karma? What it isn't? Why it matters? I'm not actually pushing this book in particular, and I wanted to have a copy to put out, and we supposedly have a copy somewhere here in the store to buy, except we couldn't find it this afternoon. It has probably gotten creatively reshelved by one of our customers or by one of our staff. Who knows? But I use that book as a visual aid because the title does speak to what I wanted to speak to, what I'd like us to all speak about tonight. And that's this word karma, that when I was young in the world, oh, those many years ago, was a word that was beginning to be become more commonly used in the English language. Of course, it had been, and Jim might know better than I, how early karma came to be used academically, in academic discourses in English language, probably the 19th century, I'm guessing.
Through theosophy.
Right. Yeah. But really, I don't think growing up in the Midwest in the 1960s that I had any occasion to think about the word or use it. Certainly, I have no recollection of that. But when in the 70s, when I was living here in the Bay Area, and eventually in 77, when I met my spiritual teacher, I came to become acquainted with the word and the uses that were prevalent around and around that word at the time. And recently, I began to think about the fact that, my gosh, I've never really rigorously examined what this word means. I mean, I knew it meant action, technically, in Sanskrit. And yet I also knew that it usually referred to action and effect of action. So there usually being a linkage there. And yet I also saw plenty of other usages and have seen plenty of other usages. And in fact, when we did a version of this talk a couple of weeks ago at an ashram in Arizona, we encountered still more iterations of ways that the word karma is used now in English. Although I'm thinking in particular right now of a German guy who speaks good English, but I'm wondering if his introduction in German might not have influenced his idiosyncratic use of the word. Anyway, it's out there, and we've got all this stuff around it, and so part of this talk is to inquire into what the uses of the word are, what they have been, how we might use them profitably. Instead, it's not meant to be an academic talk, although we do have to get into some of the background, I guess. Seems to me, anyway. In fact, this guy who used the word, the German guy that I mentioned a moment ago, was using it in a word quite consistent with some of the earlier usages, as I have come to understand them. And that is that actions have effects in the world, and that so you have the Jains, who believe that this sect in India, of course, who were well, it's hard to know exactly. Jim would know better a little bit, but certainly by the time of the Buddha and his contemporary Mahavira, the Jain great Jain teacher, we already had a Jain community, and their use of the word karma would be a pretty straightforward cause and effect model, such that and correct me if you hear anything mistaken that I'm saying, Jim. So the Jains will wear, you know, a scarf over their mouth to prevent the inhaling and destruction of insects, for example. And their idea is to, or part of the idea of the Jain sect, is to reduce their karmic effects in the world. So that includes vegetarianism, a vegetarian diet, and it includes an ideal of withdrawing from the world, essentially, so as to reduce karmic consequences to actions. Is that a fair summary?
If I may,
please.
The big distinction between Buddhism and Jainism is that Buddhism introduced the idea of intention.
I was just getting to that. Yes, I was just going to get that. That's okay. The Buddha did have a different take, as Jim has just pointed out. The Buddha had a different take, and he said that it mattered what we intended to do. In other words, I sort of gloss this as if we understand that action is not just what happens with our bodies in the world. You know, so we step on a bug or something, or we unintentionally run over. I mean, there are cases where people accidentally kill other people with cars or other tools and stuff like that. But the Buddha had the idea that our intentions matter, and I kind of understand that as a way of including our internal state as actions. That is, to be able to see what's going on internally, both in what we would describe as heart and head, as actions.
Would motive be similar to what you're saying, intent?
Sure, although motive has some connotations in English which I don't know if I would want to subscribe to that, but yeah. So if we have the intention to I'll give an example. So I give a dollar to someone who asks me for money on the street, and then 15 minutes later, when I go into the store and realize I'm a dollar short of the money that I wanted to have to buy what I wanted to purchase, I might identify with a reservation about having freely given that money away. And the Buddha would say, as I understand it, that that after the fact change of intention or motive actually diminishes whatever merit I might have accrued karmically from doing that. Makes things complicated.
So conversely then, what about somebody who gives something to someone who's poor, but only so that he could be seen by others to give credit
precisely.
Jesus, and that's what he said.
Right.
You know, so that he could be seen by others, you know, for the benefits of pride.
Absolutely.
So giving money to the poor, but on the other side, it's a very bad motive for doing so.
Well, yeah, my own teacher would used to put it is that the universe is conservative, and if the benefit of giving money to the poor is received in the form of a bolstering of pride, then the universe doesn't have to give us anything more than that. And I think there's something to that. But to get back to that more Buddhist model, it's that the interjection of intention, the interjection of this recognition that it's more than just the action in the world and its effects, creates a much more confusing, in some ways, context, because there are a million complications that arise. There are other complications too. I don't want to leave it there, but first, what was your comment, sir?
I was curious if this is consistent with what I recall of the Buddhist sixth sense thought.
I'm not familiar with exactly that usage of thought, but thought would be part of what's going on here. So, surely it's the thought that, oh, I shouldn't have given that dollar away, that is, as I understand it, a diminution of a karmic benefit to be accrued. In other words, I've frittered away part of it, at least, with that kind of second thinking. I don't know if you want to jump in here.
Yeah, I actually want to kind of go in a slightly different direction and come back to this point. Our Tayu practice is strongly influenced by the fourth way practice, the work of G.I. Gurdjieff in particular, and someone asked Gurdjieff at one point what it was that he taught, and his comment was, "I teach that when it rains, sidewalk get wet." So when I think about that, and it came up for me in regard to this talk, and it's also topical for our last few days we've had here. you know, when it rains, the sidewalk gets wet, and how do I understand that? So there's a couple of lines of influence that we've had recently from our work with the Mystical Positivist radio show that inform on this, and also from a book that Rob has read, I've been reading, that was recommended to us from our friend Ken McLeod, the Tibetan translator and teacher. So I'll start with the Mystical Positivist interview. We had a conversation with Stephen Batchelor about his book After Buddhism, and you know, he's one of the things that struck me that I hadn't really encountered, but it was an interesting point that he was making, is that he starts by describing what he understands the Buddha to have originally taught, and he frames it as four tasks, that there are four tasks that the Buddha really recommended that you find in the early suttas, and they were, as I recall, it is basically the first, the recognition of or the seeing of suffering. The next task is the, I think the, help me out with the
cause.
Recognizing what the cause of suffering is. The third task is actually releasing or letting go of that cause, and ultimately the fourth task is the abiding in a lifestyle or an ongoing practice of that release.
So those last two are a little different than the usual canonical take.
Right, but the thing that was interesting to me about and what relates to this a topic at hand is that he makes a claim in his argument that the four tasks at some point and probably subsequent to Buddha's life became the Four Noble Truths, and that there was an elevation of what begins as a, you may not agree with this, but I'm telling you what Batchelor's argument was, but his claim was that there was an elevation of what begins as a practical, pragmatic practice suddenly takes on a metaphysical coloration, or it's elevated to a truth claim, which is different than a task or a recommendation. I could give you some advice and some good advice about practice, but if I suddenly make claims about a an abiding truth of that practice, it becomes something different than just a recommendation. And karma's operates similarly for me. And before I get into that, though, I want to mention the book that our friend recommended, and that's a book called Debt, The First 5,000 Years. That's
Debt.
D-E-B-T.
Right, not death.
Debt.
This is called Ken MacLeod recommended?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's a book by an anthropologist, Graeber, what's his first name?
David Graeber.
David Graeber. And
very interesting.
It's a fascinating book. He's focused on the problem of the occurrence of and the construction of debt. He does get into some spiritual topics, but not directly. It's more of an aside. But the interesting thing about that book was to recognize and challenge for myself to what degree I have internalized a constructed idea of debt. And a constructed idea of what it means to be in debt, what it means to
have an obligation.
Yeah, what it means to have an obligation. And I hadn't really, I realized in reading that those notions for me were fairly unconscious, that I tended to think of them as givens in terms of the way the universe worked. And that was called into question. And that relates to karma because, you know, karma as a big notion, like what Rob was articulating about aspect of how my later withholding of, you know, or reservations about having given money to someone when I'm inconvenienced by that fact somehow diminishes the merit, suggests that there's some sort of accounting going on in some metaphysical realm that impacts the consequences in very interesting ways to actions that I take. And that's a big claim. And a lot of the claims around karma, when it gets used as this karma with a capital K to me, also have this sense of a truth claim as opposed to a pragmatic reflection about how the universe works. When it rains, sidewalk gets wet. So when I think about it in terms of when it rains, sidewalk gets wet, for me, karma becomes more of a pragmatic advice that my actions have consequences. What I do have consequences. My intentionality or lack of intentionality around an action have consequences as well, and many of the consequences are not unlike some of the consequences of suffering. If I cling to ideas or interpretations about what happens in life, if I have expectations that I cling to, and if I ascribe my identity and my stability of self to those ideas, then if something comes along that changes that, I'm likely to suffer, or I'm likely to have an internal disruptive experience. And if I further then react to that, I create a chain of activities and actions and reactions that can have reasonably predictable consequences, at least on the short term when we see these things happen. And so it makes sense to me that my actions have consequences. Makes sense to me within certain realms that in my intentionality is tied into that, and yet I think Jim, you're the one who told me that the Jain argument to the Buddhists about intentionality is that if I throw the trash out into a fire and it happens to have a baby in it, it doesn't matter whether I have an intention or not, I'm still responsible for the consequences. Yeah.
Just as a footnote, the early Jain texts actually mock Buddhists for including intentionality in the notion of karma. And that's the example
right.
They give. If I accidentally throw a baby into a fire, then they say, oh, if I'm a Buddhist, that doesn't matter. There's no, it has no consequences that I burned a baby because I didn't intend to. So the Jains and the Buddhists really were very clear with each other about that difference.
And
of course, the Jains are wrong.
but you know, that whole argument, or that back and forth, is a good example of where pragmatism starts to turn into truth, because of course intention matters in some cases, and of course in other cases intention isn't the only factor that matters. And we can argue this lots of different ways, but from a pragmatic point of view, of course, if I throw a baby into the fire and I don't realize I'm doing that, I'm responsible, and there's going to be suffering that ensues from that and consequences from that action. But there is an intention at some point, probably, in not paying attention in a certain way that I may...
I'm curious why you say, of course. I'm sorry for interrupting.
Sure. Why do I say
you threw in the, of course, yeah, we're going to be responsible, so could you...
Yeah, well, that's a good challenge. I thank you for that point, because that first, I will be honest enough to say that, of course, I think is coming from the programming I was talking about earlier, where I'm just wired to think about negative consequences to action. Because if it didn't matter, if my actions didn't have consequences in that way, if it didn't matter, means that the world and the way I think of it may be quite meaningless, and that's a very threatening thought. But I do think it matters in the sense that if I look at it more, in the spirit of if it rains, sidewalk gets wet, there are certain things that come after that. If I inadvertently create harm for a being, if I become aware of that, I will undoubtedly just because I know how I'm constructed, I will suffer. If other people are aware and authority-bearing entities in my life become aware of that action, there will certainly be material consequences.
Right, but for me, it's important to distinguish consequences from responsibility. Even at law, you're not responsible for the homicide.
Yeah, certainly.
So that's what I'm saying. There's obviously going to be grief, it's consequence of grief, well, above, but the question of responsibility is a category difference.
I think that's a great category to bring up.
But I was just going to respond that the law has not always been construed that way. So in the Middle Ages...
Same story.
Intention
has not always been construed.
Yeah. So all these things are have been subject to negotiation over time, yeah, and they remain so. Honestly, I served as a jury foreman a couple of years ago, and the particular case is a civil case, and it was about money. It was all about money. That, some guy had fallen in a facility owned by a hospital, and they... the hospital stipulated that they had not maintained it in a safe way, so all it was about money, except when the deliberations in the jury room were happening. Let me tell you that intentionality on both sides was part of the discussion, and I don't think inappropriately so. But not taking some programmatic idea about responsibility overly seriously, but also not dismissing responsibility to pay attention when it's raining. You might take a little more care when you walk down the stairs or something like that. It's like these things are not set in stone, and that's part of it. One of the phrases that came to me when we first started talking about doing this talk is a black box. That is to say, it seems to me that most people treat, and I have absolutely done this myself, most of us treat the idea of karma as a black box. You have a consequence at one end, a cause at one end, and there's the black box, and out the other end is supposed to come some kind of consequence, except... when is it due? What nature does it have? How is it affected by other causes affecting what's happening between these two points along the way? And that it seems to me is an important way to Well, it's been a way in which people have simplified things, I think, inappropriately. Oh. Certainly I have simplified things inappropriately in the past when I thought about karma. And, you know, we could bring in the whole idea of karma in this life and karma from additional lives.
So the question I have is that in that regard, you know, when we talk about the popular use of karma, and I think about how I was first introduced to the word, you know, like people say, oh, he's got bad karma or something. It's indistinguishable from the word luck.
Or fate.
Yeah.
Sometimes.
You know, you got bad luck, bad things happen. You've got bad karma, you know. So
it's continues to be misused today, even today, in not just in places like India, where, you know, the attribution of caste is tied up with
right.
karma, what kind of life you get born into, what kind of body you get born into, are you born into a Brahmin body or untouchable body, right? Well, but the same thing is absolutely used in the West as well.
Yeah.
We just don't call it necessarily karma, but...
Call it original sin.
We might call it original sin. Or
just desserts.
Yeah, just exactly, just desserts, you know? So if you don't have money, then... And then you look at someone who does because of no virtue on their part, apparent virtue. We could even point to people that we hear about in the news a lot in that regard. But how do we account for that? Well, we throw the word karma out there, which interjects the black box into the conversation implicitly, and so we've absolved ourselves of thinking rigorously about what we're actually saying.
And it's true that the distinction with karma and luck is that if someone has bad luck, you know, they're you might say they're a victim of circumstances, but there's not an implicit responsibility on their part. And therefore, you know, one might feel inclined to help someone who's been a victim of bad luck.
Yeah, I don't know that.
If someone is a victim of bad karma, then it is, as you said, just desserts. You now, you know, you are the chickens have come home to roost. You have reaped what you have sown, and therefore it's perfectly appropriate to allow you to stew in the consequences of your metaphysical mess, and it becomes a justification for actually withholding help. Because it's what,
or actually even worse than withholding help, actually maintaining conditions that maintain that
right.
that cause the condition of hard luck to persist for the person experiencing it.
To me, this is the most important point of discussion about karma, is what we're talking about mm-hmm. here, and mm-hmm. I call it the use and abuse of karma.
Yeah,
because it is the abuse of karma to insert the question of deserving.
I couldn't agree more, but let's hear other voices.
I'm just curious, are you saying that way of viewing karma is inaccurate? Because there's a term karmic imprint that mm-hmm. you know that karma ripens, and if it doesn't happen in this life, it could ripen in the next. I just that's what I was taught by pretty rigorous teachers.
Sure. And so I mean there's a lot to say about that, but this idea of the ripening of karma also depends on in the Buddhist view on causes and conditions.
Right.
So karma. And that distinguishes it from another way. It is distinguished then from the Jain and pre-Buddhist view in India of karma as action and consequence. So if there are, as we can, at least I would take it to be fairly hard to argue with the idea that there are many causes operating on any of us at any given time, in any situation. It's not just, you know, we can say that, yeah, the Titanic hit the iceberg. Okay, that was a pretty big that was a pretty big cause, no doubt about it. But it wasn't the only thing that caused the Titanic to go down and people to die.
Buddhism has five major categories of causes, and karma is only one of them.
Exact. That's part of it. That's part of the the Buddha made a point. For example, this is another realm where an example of your use and abuse. So when people get cancer or some other terrible disease, AIDS, it was easy basically for a lot of Americans to say that people with AIDS
right.
in the 80s deserved what they got.
Well,
because after all, they were having too much fun.
More majority guys were saying it out loud.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's absolutely right. But even today, when people get cancer, even though there's a lot more medical intervention happening to prevent people from dying of cancer, much more successfully now. But even now, if people get a major disease, then it's not infrequent for you to hear a whisper about how they didn't act. They acted in a way to cause their own illness. And the Buddha was actually incredibly clear. I mean, there's in the suttas, the Pali Canon, there's examples of the Buddha addressing precisely this point and saying, no, there's these other things.
Environmental causes is one of the other, I can't remember all five, but environmental causes is one of the other five major categories.
Right. There's a whole list of things.
I wanted to just mention in response to your question, we're not really at this point trying to assert that any one interpretation is right or wrong. If anything, you might say we're taking a postmodern approach here in that we're...
No, we're not.
Well, what I mean by that is we're just trying to look at what the underpinnings of the different interpretations are and what that means. And as I said before, the question that's of interest for me is the more... assertive a claim is of what karma is as a kind of a metaphysical entity, the more I feel that claim needs more examination, because it makes an assertion that is more challenging to verify in my direct experience. I can verify some basic things about cause and effect in my experience, and certainly the tradition that I practice in is very pragmatic in the sense that it's any truth claim needs to be verified in one's experience. So many times I think metaphysical claims, I treat them as tools. Are they useful? Do they help draw me towards a deeper connection with my life, my practice, the world around me, or does it become an occasion for unnecessary fluctuations of my mind in, imagining potential consequences that derive from the concept?
So is your sense that traditionally what you're talking about was what was applied then?
So...
maybe this is what you're saying when you say this is a postmodern viewpoint.
I've been joking a little bit because I know that irritates Rob, but about what I mean by
well,
that
I
is
think it's well, a bit of practice viewpoint.
Well, what I mean, like when I spoke about the influence of the book Debt for me, I realized that I had internalized a certain way of seeing things in terms of obligation and owing and being born into obligation. In fact, the fourth way, the Gurdjieff work, is replete with terminology about the obligations that we have to our endlessness for our arising, for our existence. And these were things that, I've just sort of breathed in and inherited, and they formed a particular way of seeing things. So when I was confronted with the idea that actually if you try to find, in the anthropological record, the way that people actually exchanged things and interrelated with each other before agrarian societies became more structured, it actually doesn't... There are as many different ways of negotiating obligation exchange and what it means to owe and what it means to give as there are people. And I realized that it made me call into question whether this sense of obligation that I internalize is something that is objective and real, or whether is it a useful way of orienting myself with regard to practice, because it gives me kind of an anchor by which I can organize my activities that ultimately lead to a, as I said, a deeper connection to my being and my life. Mm-hmm. So there's the distinction I'm drawing is, you know, is something useful, is something pragmatic, versus is it true? And that's why I was saying that we're not trying to say right or wrong here. It's a, if anything, we're taking a more utilitarian approach as what are the effects of these different ideas in terms of how we practice. Does that make sense?
Right. I'm glad you're doing this, but I'm just hearing a lot of self-reflection, and I wonder if traditionally that would be the case, or was it traditionally karma just seen as this more kind of mechanistic process?
Well, I mean, there's historical, Jim has something to say about this, but I just want to interject really quickly that one of the things I got out of this book that I pointed to earlier is an historical development of complexity, and so I want to hear what Jim has to say about that.
At the time of the Buddha, what I discovered is that there were discussions like this about the nature of karma. And the different traditions would actually have public debates centered on this topic. So for the what became Hinduism based on the Rig Veda, the term karma is used in the Rig Veda means ritual efficacy. So that if you do the ritual correctly, you'll get a certain result. And the ultimate result is to become a god. Okay, so but you have to do it right. And the right person has to do the ritual. And then in the Rig Veda, uses karma as meaning there will be a consequence to that. And the consequence is that you will be apotheosized. Mm-hmm. In a way. Mm-hmm. And the Jain view was that actions have consequences and they are unavoidable and unmitigatable.
And that's one of the views that this German guy that I talked about earlier was articulating.
Right.
So,
and they, you know, and their view was either that interpretation of karma was grounded in ahimsa, or that karma view gave rise to their commitment to ahimsa.
Right.
So their view is that if you take a life, there will be negative consequences, mechanistically. Mm-hmm. You know, like mm-hmm. that will happen inevitably. There's
right.
no way out of that except to withdraw, you know, like from interaction. And what the Buddha introduced, probably the Ajivikas did as well, was that in the psychological or spiritual intention, motivation, you know, like all of those factors, that's what actually determines karma. So. And these three views are different. I mean, they have overlapping things, but what I'm hearing from Rob and Stuart is that in a way you can see all three of those meanings today.
Mm-hmm.
Plus the one you mentioned about luck, which I hadn't thought of, but you're absolutely right. I mean, that was really interesting to me. A lot of things clicked in. You know, like the people do use colloquially the word karma for luck or lack of luck.
Yeah, I
think it's fate. I think it's used as an. I think it's used as for fate.
Fate and grace. I think grace also. You know, karma sometimes is used where you could use the term grace too.
Right. You go ahead. You wanted to say something.
Just one last thought bubbling up is, mm-hmm. is that also in Buddhism is the idea of gaining merit.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yes.
Right.
You can balance off your whatever. Negative consequences.
Which is another aspect of is that use or abuse of karma
mm-hmm.
by
right.
Buddhists, because we can use and abuse the notion of merit in the same way
right.
that karma can be used and abused.
Right.
Yeah, and I think that the notion of merit is, you know, and some of the ways in which that got systematized or practiced starts to sound a whole lot like the influence of the ledgers for debt,
right,
which
right,
actually, exactly. which had their, incidentally, had their origins in the temples.
Uh-huh.
you know, right. the temples were the great organizing places, and the where materials would be.
This is from that book, Debt.
Yeah, this is where materials would be, you know, brought together, and people would, you know, take materials, but then they would incur an obligation that would be like in Mesopotamia, etched onto the clay tablets. So there's an interesting social practice that has a whole, you know, that plays right into this notion of this accounting book somewhere.
That's a fascinating analogy.
It's a book worth checking out.
So there's one more thing I want to throw out, which is a different spin on obligation, karma, and responsibility. And there's two things, two impressions I've had. One was a spiritual teacher that we knew has passed away now, once made a comment, I think this was in a talk or a comment he made to his students, that you know, he'd had his astrological charts done, and you know, he could notice that his life seemed to progress according to the charts up until the point where what he identified as his enlightenment experience, where there was a profound shift in the perspective that he operated under. So after that, nothing correlated. Mm-hmm. And that, I want to relate that to a notion in the Gurdjieff work, which is the notion of the law of accidents, which is when one is operating in the ordinary kind of semi-asleep human consciousness, in which our minds are completely identified with the thoughts that are going on and our perceptions about the world, we're subject to the law of accidents, which, you know, you can say, you know, stuff happens, you know, and there's no sense, cause, or, you know, you can impose some causes and things like that, but it's more or less random. However, when one embarks on a path of intentionality, and I mean intention not in terms of what I think is going to happen, but more a commitment to practice in some way where one's bringing your attention to life, a spiritual path, that one ultimately moves off of the law of accidents, and what happens in one's life is, in a sense, a conversation with the universe, in which case, and in that place, we can use the experiences of our lives, good or bad, as food for deepening the cultivation of our presence. And that was first brought home to me by my own spiritual teacher very early on, when he told me quite seriously that I was responsible for everything. Mm-hmm. No matter what, if an airplane dropped on my head, I was responsible. And, you know, from the point of view of pragmatism, it didn't matter whether that was metaphysically true or not. If you actually begin to internalize and look at the world as though whatever happens to you is you're responsible, you being responsible means you're able to respond. And in that way, I can say from a pragmatic point of view that your perspective, your experience of life will shift if you take as a practice that you are responsible for everything.
That's why, going back to what you were talking about, which the ripening thing sparked up when we were talking about deserving, mm-hmm. the issue of deserving, which is that. So when you confront the poor person on the doorstep and you say, oh, he deserves his situation, if I feel I'm responsible for his situation as much as I'm responsible for mine, because this is the universe that I'm confronting, I'm responsible for everything that I'm present with, then we don't have that's his karma and my karma. It's the karma of this moment, and I have to act. And my action in that moment will be the karma that reverberates. Mm. So if I say, oh, he deserves what he gets, that's a karma-creating thought.
Yeah.
That
Absolutely.
Seals my own identity into a frozen matrix.
Yeah, I mean the utility of the ripening metaphor, because it's a metaphor. It's not a metaphysical reality, or if it is, then we don't know how to access it directly. But that metaphor is useful precisely because compared to what had gone before, as Jim was describing, with, you know, the ritual efficacy of the Rig Veda, the views, the sort of rigid mechanistic action consequence views. When this understanding of ripening arises, then the two things happen. It's not just intention, although that does make room for intention to have an effect, because if we realize that our motives matter, we also realize that if we practice in a certain way, mind practice, heart practice, body practice, if we practice in certain ways, we can change what arises in our experience, because we're changing the conditions that cause some things to arise in our minds and other things not to arise in our minds and hearts. So it's actually a huge, you know, and to use the current hand term, empowerment, it's an empowering step to add this this image of ripening. And it's also useful because we also, you know, we've already talked about the idea that, well, clearly we're not talking about consequences right away sometimes. You know, some rich person treats people badly and they get elected president of the United States, you know? And is that, what happened to the karma there? Well, apparently there must be some other causes and conditions going on, right? And the ripening metaphor helps us to understand how these things might act and how it further helps us, I think, with what Gregory was saying about you know, the ways in which I'm present to the co-creation of karma between, you know, him and I, for example. And so that helps us understand that the ripening is happening in many dimensions, in many ways, at different times, because different conditions are present, and the conditions that are present are influenced by my own cultivation or absence thereof. And if it's absence, then it's back to the, you know, the fourth way mechanical model, which leads to more of the Buddhist suffering. So these things are helpful tools. I mean, if there's any one thing that is my intention with this talk, it's to recognize that these ideas are not themselves reality. They are simply tools that are sometimes useful for us to use, because they can help us find compassionate ways to interact with one another, compassionate ways to be with ourselves, ways that enhance our creativity, as opposed to repress and deny it. So that's kind of. I don't see it as postmodern, and that's why I went. That's when I made a raspberry.
Well, you have a whole different sense of that than I do.
I do have, because I've had more training in that academic realm where possibility is not the product of some of that. Some of those skeins of thought, but anyway, that's the
yeah.
Carol,
I'm having a lot of parallel thoughts with the group conversation here, and some of them relate to Stuart's introduction of the economics. That relates to a concept for me of balance.
Mm-hmm.
You've got debts that need to be balanced, and karmic debts that need to be balanced. And you've introduced the concept of time,
mm-hmm.
where we seem to be dealing with something that is actually outside the field of normally experienced forward arrow of time,
mm-hmm.
because there can apparently be retrocausative influences on karma. Mm-hmm. And I was constructing a model of it as you were talking originally when you mentioned the black box, and thinking about the entire circumstances out of which the event in question occurs constellates the transfer function inside the box for what happens, what the karmic result is. So the whole thing depends on knowledge, which not only do we not have, we are not equipped to have the antecedents for any action.
Well,
are so complex.
Depends on where you locate those antecedents. I mean, in terms of what you were saying about, you know, to use your analogy of, you know, what's in the box or the mm-hmm. transfer function in the box
yeah.
as being related to the thoughts and impressions and habits and tendencies I have in relationship to my perceptions of a situation. That is subject to our inquiry. That is subject to our exploration through practices like mindfulness or self-observation.
I would submit that that is only part of the picture of involving the karma, because there are parts which, in our conventional minds at least, we're not privy to. We who knows what led the person's father's, grandfather's, uncle's assassin to do what he did, that eventually had something to do with the karmic chain here, that wound up through another route meeting on the high seas in a rowboat, and somebody gets to live and somebody gets to die. I mean, the questions of causality can be so incredibly complex that to deal with them in any kind of a thought process, for me, I would find that impossible.
Right, but I think the, I guess what comes up for me is again, what are we? How are we trying to use the tool?
Well, what does it do? What's the function of the tool?
So, I mean, I don't. My sense of the tool of karma is not to help me elucidate the matrix of complex causes in a chaotic system that we live in. It's more to help me meet the immediacy of my experience and to try to be present to that and not be in reaction or mechanical reaction to that, but to be present to what's happening and try to respond from some sort of authentic place.
Is that the same thing as you're paying attention?
Kind of. It's there's nuances in what I was describing, because paying attention can sometimes be very focused, but I prefer the term being present.
Okay.
But what I mean by that is, you know, this is why for me karma is partly about accepting responsibility for what happens,
mm-hmm.
because then there's an occasion of practice where I can be present to the reactivity in myself, and to the extent that I can deepen that presence, I have the possibility of choice as to whether to identify with that reaction or to allow something new or novel to proceed.
But is the idea in that sense of karma being used as something which you have to pay attention, otherwise karma's going to get you, or
let's say I'd put it,
that's actually one of the common uses of the term.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, that's correct, and you know that is a way that I actually use it. In the fourth way, we call that a reminding factor, because it's like. It's a reminder that if I do not pay attention, mm-hmm. then I will fall into the law of accidents, to use the term I used earlier, in which case I will be subject to effects that I may not consciously intend, but will be products of my unconscious, unexamined habits and tendencies.
So is this an empirically derived law, the law of karma?
Well, I guess I would say that... my usage of it in the way that I'm describing is I have empirically tested a pragmatic tool and found that it has benefits for my spiritual practice.
But see, that's the problem with the word law.
Uh-huh.
So if you're imputing by using that word, you're imputing a natural, you know, something from another whole discourse into and onto this idea of karma as Stuart's propagating it, and he didn't use the word law.
I used tool.
Okay.
Yeah.
How did the Buddha present it?
Well, actually, he would have been a critic of, I believe, of the use of law, because that's a metaphysical assertion, and he was as I understand it, quite practical. As I said, mm-hmm. you know, he's using it, and there's another thing in what you said, which follows along with this, which is that you said something like, well, you know, karma has to balance, and there's the, you know, it's that ledger thing,
mm-hmm.
and the point I was trying to make earlier is, if you understand karma in this more fluid way, then actually karma doesn't have to mature. Karma doesn't have to have a consequence if you apply your practice consciousness in such a way as to prevent the watering and fertilization of the seed that would otherwise mechanically arise and mm-hmm. bite you in the ass. So
that's an important point, and I think you might want to go back and circle around it again, because it might not communicate well.
Yeah.
Are you getting into adhering and non-adhering?
No, the seed and the causes and conditions that get around the idea of the invariable law of karma.
Right. Mm.
The law of karma is a law in the sense of the law of gravity, perhaps, but we can get around the law of gravity if we have a plane that gets us up and down. And that's a very loose metaphor for
actually it's not bad actually
yeah.
because it's causes and conditions. We create different conditions and such that we can actually literally fly to the moon, which the law of gravity would seem to naturally prevent us from doing.
So the law of karma is, it's not a totally universal thing. It's like, you could say it's like the law of gravity, and there's other laws of the universe that we can work with.
Right, or you can negotiate that law,
yeah.
or you can work with
yeah.
that law in such a way that it doesn't foreordain the consequences.
I think what you were saying about the seeds and the ripening, and you can withhold the watering of a seed that has already been planted,
right.
and the force of that karma won't ripen
because
we thought, using the model that you were saying, get rid of the law of accidents. If we plant a seed and we water it and stuff, well, it may seem like an accident, but it grows. But if we say, I'm not going to be just unconscious about this, I'm going to not water that and water this seed, then we do cultivate.
Well, let me give you a practical example of this, you know, and this is one that's quite relevant for me personally, and that is, someone is driving and they do something with their car that I don't like them doing, right? So what options do I have in the realm of motive? What seeds do I water? The seed exists of thinking, oh, you jerk, right? Oh, you blanking jerk, right? And yet, I don't have to water, and I don't have to fertilize. I mean, there's a, you know, the seed rose, the seed, you know, the universe is full of seeds in this way, in our minds and in our hearts and elsewhere, right? Yeah, and so if I train myself not to automatically and compulsively water and fertilize that seed, then it will not bear fruit. It will not bear fruit. That's an everyday practical example, and I'm not saying it's easy by any means, and yet that's the kind of that's the way in which I understand what the Buddha was saying about karma, to actually free us from the mechanical understanding of karma, as this mechanistic cause and effect, whether you have a black box or not.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
In the Philokalia, that's called provocation and coupling. So
sounds
the provocation
hot.
The provocation was there for you to get mad at the person who did that.
Right, right.
But if you don't act on it, if you act on it, then you're
coupling. Okay, I got
then
it.
You're
I
coupling,
got it.
But if
yeah.
And so sin, from their point of view, sin only starts at coupling, not provocation.
Right, right, yeah, exactly.
Right.
Which is an interesting point, different than Jimmy Carter's view, by the way, as you may recall, because he said he had sinned in his heart because he looked at Playboy or something like that.
He lusted after.
That's right. He lusted after someone
in his mind, in his heart.
I missed what you said. In such and such, it's called provocation and coupling.
Philokalia.
That's a word I've never heard.
It's from the Eastern Orthodox tradition.
Oh,
it's a beautiful
collection of teachings.
Right.
Oh, okay.
Right.
Thank you.
It seems important to clarify, from my experience and understanding,
mm-hmm.
there's the distinction between feeling angry and acting it out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, in a sense, that's what I was using, that metaphor of watering, fertilizing seeds, or not, or withholding fertilization, or fertilizing and watering, you know, withholding food from an impulse. So my understanding of what Stuart has just been saying and of what the Buddha has said is that we have the capacity through training in spiritual practice to not automatically and compulsively, and through the Eastern Orthodox understanding, to not have to go to anger in that particular case, or to fear, in some ways even more primal. And that's, you know, that's incredibly powerful work to engage in.
And it's a process, and it's a practice. You know, it's not like we turn a switch and all of a sudden everything is turned off. But to me, it's more like an art, something you go back to, you keep going back to, and one's discrimination and catching the arising of an invitation to couple, to use your term, becomes subtler and subtler.
Right.
I do have a point.
Mm-hmm.
From a Christian point of view on this whole thing, the central theme of Christianity, of course, is the cross. And that's all to avoid karma. That's the whole point of it.
I hadn't thought about that exactly in those using that terminology.
The
but
whole point of the cross was that
sure.
Jesus was taking on the sins of the world.
Yeah, no,
taking
I
on
get
everybody's
it.
Karma.
Right. I get what you're saying, and I can see how that would, you know, be a good interpretation of it.
Right.
Thank you. Well, any other comments, questions, observations?
Are there any theories on karma of a group?
Yes, absolutely. Actually, that was one of the things I was going to get to. And honestly, this is an area to me, like this book, you know, has a brief discussion. It's a thin little book. It's very good, actually. I do highly recommend it if you're interested in all this discussion tonight. But there is a discussion of group karmas, and honestly, it's you know, if the karma of an individual, or if the karma of just two people, is complicated enough,
uh-huh.
Imagine how complicated it is to envision the karma of the United States, or the karma of Sebastopol.
The karma of a mob.
The karma of church members, you know, members of a congregation or sangha or something like that. I mean, yeah, it's incredibly complicated. So there are views, you know, this now deceased Tibetan author of this book definitely asserts that in fact this is stuff that the Buddha was clear could be factors in our experience, for sure. And I think that's probably true. And my sense at this moment is that saying much more than that is really, really problematic.
No, I'll say something more.
Well, just to put your head on that in that line.
Well, I have a background in some scientific training, so I think of group karma kind of the way you think about solid state physics, where you have a collection of a bunch of people. There are certain things that
I hate that term solid state physics. It sounds to me like a block of platinum or something. What does that mean?
But when you have a collection of the behaviors of the individuals can reinforce over a collective, and you begin to see emergent properties of the collective that are reified and amplified by the individuals, but no one individual is sort of like the complete cause. And in that sense, when I look at group happenings like what's been going on in the U.S., I can sort of intuitively feel like there are these kind of dynamic threads that may represent yearnings and themes and things like that that have been playing out since the early days of the European incursion onto the continent. and these are all, it's been this kind of ongoing conversation that every now and then bursts into great violence and then sort of relaxes again, and we're seeing a particular form of that now.
And yet what's going to happen next?
Yeah,
it doesn't help you at
all.
It
doesn't help me predict, because in a sense it doesn't, I'm not even sure if we know, what the outcome would be. We might know that if there's more self-reflection at a larger scale, that might change the nature of the outcome.
Absolutely.
And that gives us an intuition as to how we might act appropriately. Mm-hmm. Is my actions in response to the political situation today born out of reactivity? Is it born out of a deep sense of reflection? Is it born out of compassion? Those individual opportunities I have for participating in the larger activities of the collective will have an effect on what happens in that collective. And if I, by acting, say, compassionately or acting from a deep place of inner silence or something like that, also inspire others to do that, there's possibilities that a coherent, different kind of movement might arise. And so in that sense, I see that looking at things in that way gives us a sense of how we might act, and to challenge us that to the extent that we are reactive to the situation of the larger group, we will probably continue to propagate the current dynamics that we're in reaction to, if that makes sense.
No, that's scientifically, but that's a really important point.
It is an important point, and I'll just interject here that I have a lot of friends in different sanghas, spiritual communities, and some people are coming together. People are coming together in various ways in order to simply practice or meditate with the intention of creating an effect along the lines that Stuart is describing. In our tradition, we have an aphorism that no effort is wasted. And so far, 39 years of experience has only strengthened my conviction that there's something to that aphorism. So in that sense, even though my mind can't predict what the effects will be, I do have the sense that there are ways in which I can participate in what's happening in ways that are not simply going to add to the continuing despair, anger, and other reactive responses that are present, triumph.
And at the same time, not be in denial.
Right. Absolutely.
We're not talking about putting on a happy face and saying everything is rosy, but also responding from a deeper place from within us that isn't in reaction to what's happening, but is asserting a positive vision of an alternative. And the more we can speak from that place, the more we can offer that up as individuals and as small groups of individuals and then larger groups of individuals, something can bubble up that may actually create a different karma, if you will.
Yeah. So thank you for that, asking the question. I'm glad we can end at that on that point, assuming that that is the end, or then there's no other questions.
Well, to me, I think on this point, it's really important that karma is as complex as genetics and weather. Although you say
chaos of karma.
Yeah, exactly. There's that chaos principle involved there, because you say when it rains, sidewalk wet, but the rain started somewhere out in the Pacific, and before that, and we know that that hurricanes are going to come every year, but we don't know what day and what direction they're going to go, and we know that genetics, we're starting to map the genome, but we still can't, manipulate it or anything like that. So we're in trying to get that empirical study of karma. We're back at Linnaeus and the pea pods. We're not really very into understanding first the carrier of karma, and I assert that the carrier of karma is identity. So that because we have identity as an individual, we have identity as a family member, we have identity as a Sebastopolian or an American, that's how the group karma gets carried, with how we fit into the identity sphere.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's where how it gets that so complex when we start thinking about it. But yes, I would say that there is group karma, and it works individually through our being and identified within the group. As part of the group identity.
Right. And I think, as we were saying earlier, that identity or that identification are the things that we have an opportunity to explore, release, loosen.
Right. I don't get out of the
relax.
American karma just by saying, oh, I'm not an American. Well, here I am, and I've got a California driver's license and stuff. So I can't just
absolutely. You're paying taxes every time you buy some of our delicious tea here. Actually, not taxes on tea. Take that back.
the books,
the awesome books we have. That's right. Well, thank you. Yeah, it, and that's why, as you point out, there are these differing levels of identification, and I like that formulation of karma operating on those different levels, at those different levels, and often we're not even aware that we're acting in a way to in conformity with these usually unseen aspects of our actions. So that was my intention for this talk, is to bring up this topic full of all these problematic things, and to leave us even more confused in some ways, but more actually I don't feel more confused. I actually feel gratified that there are other people interested in examining this. That's actually that feels good to me, that people are take this query seriously and are willing to examine it seriously and lightly, because we're having fun too, right? I hope.
A movie, Manchester by the Sea.
I haven't seen it.
Oh, but the idea of consequences and intent, that deals a lot with exactly that concept.
I've heard good things about it. Got it. Thank you. Any final comments, questions? I will say one final comment. So Stuart and I, because this store is owned and operated by Taiyu Meditation Center, we have a Tuesday evening group meeting where we actually do some of the practices that allow us to, it's called to follow your bliss, first follow your dread. So the idea, of course, being that we need to have a realistic appreciation for that which we fear before we can have a chance of experiencing that bliss. So I'll just let people know about that. It happens Tuesdays at 7:30.
Joseph Campbell there, and of course the hero's journey in following the bliss, you always meet the monster.
Oh yeah, well yeah. You don't just start off at the end.
Right.
Exactly.
You start off following your bliss, and all of a sudden you meet the monster.
Right. Exactly.
And we find following your dread is a useful formulation of practice and the intent to practice,
right, right.
And to be fearless in facing what we find.
Right.
We also,
that's the definition of courage, right? That we're afraid, but we go
right
forward with our fear.
Right.
And we have a radio show.
Oh, right, of course. We'll tell people
about
it. I'm not sure we have someone immediately.
Actually, we were going to put this talk on
the next
radio show.
Yeah, so it's so the show is called The Mystical Positivist, and it is airs Saturdays from 4 to 6 on KOWS, which you can find online more effectively than you can listen to it right now, because we're being pushed out by a Christian rock station in Baltimore. But we have podcasts on
that are posted. Must be bad karma.
Yeah, we have podcasts that are posted online. So,
and I like those because I download them and listen to them while I commute.
Oh, good.
Yeah, and
it's actually an easier way to access it for most people.
Me too.
Yeah, we get some interesting conversations with people. That the wonderful thing about media is that people often don't know who you are, so you can end up having good conversations with even relatively well-known authors and teachers and things like that. We'll talk to local people, and we'll talk to people that we've never met who agree to come on the show, and basically try to have conversations like we've had tonight, and about important matters of contemporary spiritual practice.
Well, I'm always impressed by how much you guys are prepared with your guests.
We tried to read the books.
We actually tried to read the guy's book, or the person's book, beforehand.
It makes a difference, because it's like an hour and 45 minute conversation, and usually the guests will comment because we've gone so in depth and read their material that it's a unique interview for them, because
it goes fast.
Because they're used to the 5-minute sound bite or something on as opposed to having a real conversation about their work.
Right. So thank you all. This has been fun for me. And
thank you.
I hope.
There's a donation bowl in the front. So if you want to accrue merit,
the more merit, baby.
The bigger the donation, the more merit you will receive.
Call it the merit bowl.
Exactly.
Let's just be clear about that.
If it were ceramic, it'd be a merit crockery.
All right. Thank you all.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Betty. Good.